From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. After more than three decades in this game, filmmaker Kevin Smith has devised his own ways of winning over audiences for his projects, including his latest film, Clerks 3.
You know, we can release them on Fathom screens so everybody could go see them if they're near a Fathom event screening. But I'm going to be on the road with my movie, sitting down every night with 1,000 people consuming this. And every night it was like going to a church where I was both the priest and Jesus at the same time.
Oh, Kevin Smith talks on many topics, including his recent Netflix animated Masters of the Universe series, the cancellation of Batgirl, and his belief in the future of NFTs. But first, we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, another setback in the Warner Brothers Discovery quest for someone to run DC. That would be Dan Lin, the prolific producer, who really seemed to have gotten into quite an in-depth conversation with them. And then we are told that that collapsed, ostensibly because of issues of what would happen to his company and foundation that he has. I'm a little skeptical about that. I'm hoping to learn more, because it feels to me that if you want to run DC and they want you to run DC, those things are the kinds of things that get solved. But boy, this problem does not go away for Warner Brothers Discovery. And we've talked about how the odds are sort of, you know, it's so difficult because they have this great Batman, Superman, all this Wonder Woman, all this stuff. And yet it's so difficult. They're constantly compared with Marvel. They, you know, they think they can find a Kevin Feige, which is very hard to do. And then, you know, you have the Zack Snyder fans who wanted that version and are still obsessed. The ones who hated that version and are equally obsessed in some cases. It's just such a difficult job and they still haven't solved it.
And awkwardly right now, they've got a guy who is currently running DC in Walter Hamada. Yeah. Who is watching this, you know, search play out from the perch of his job running DC. So I just don't know why this has all been so tough for them. I mean, it's a very difficult job. And in this day and age, when you start negotiating with someone, these things tend to leak out. But from everything I've heard, it's kind of back to the drawing board at this point. And like you said, you know, you got to make that deal work. I know Warner Brothers Discovery is cash strapped and they don't want to overpay. And Dan Lin has a lot of projects set up all over town. And as producer of the Lego movies, like buying his company would have been very expensive. But the alternative now is that they have got a very public search to happen again. And the added element here is the diversity thing. You know, Warner Brothers Discovery has a lot of white male executives, and they have more than the previous version of this company had. So here with Dan Lin, you had a person of color who would have stepped into this role and replaced someone, Walter Hamada, who is also a person of color. If they're going to try to find an executive now, I think the pressure will be on for some diversity in that role.
Yeah, there was maybe a Zaslav effect here. You know, I look at what happens with the film studio. He hires Mike DeLuca and Pam Abdy to run the film studio. Then it's, Alan Horn is a consultant on the film studio. Then it's John Goldwyn and Terry Press, you know, who's a veteran marketing executive and Oscar campaigner. And they're consultants, and John Goldwyn is a producer and former executive at Paramount long ago. How many people are in the kitchen with this guy? And from what I understand, he hires them, but he doesn't necessarily listen to any of them. So there may be people starting to feel like, maybe this won't be so fun.
Well, the DC job that they want is bigger than just film. They want someone to be a brand owner, where it's film, television, consumer products, games, everything DC. So that does go outside of the film studio.
Yeah, well, work to do, let's just say. I don't even know who the dream candidate is at this point. Let me just briefly mention Disney. As we're speaking, the thousands of fans are gathering for their D23 conference, sort of like their Disney Con. They will be wowed with all this stuff. You know, they'll get a look at all kinds of movies and this and that. Disney, meanwhile, is offering a lot of perks now for Disney Plus subscribers that really shows the might of a company like Disney. You know, if you're a Disney Plus subscriber and you buy two rides on a Disney cruise, you get two more for free. You might get early access to a theme park. You might get merchandise opportunities. This is Disney showing what a multifaceted company can do and trying to kind of even create something beyond what, say, an Amazon can provide, well beyond, because, you know, Amazon doesn't have theme parks yet.
No, they don't. But it is a replication of the Prime model, where if you are an Amazon Prime customer, you get their video product for free. You get discounts at Whole Foods. You know, there are other perks there. And Disney is looking at their assets and being like, wait a second, we're the Walt Disney Company. We are so much bigger than a streaming service. We have these theme parks that our fans love. We have cruises. We've got all of this other stuff. And it really is smart to mobilize that fandom and say, listen, you become a member here, we are going to give you the goods. And then you bring them in. And just like Amazon did, you slowly raise the price of those perks. And it makes perfect sense. This is also part of the metaverse strategy for Disney, where they're trying to use Disney Plus as this interface where someday you will have a Disney avatar and you will interact with other Disney fans and buy things and maybe go to a virtual theme park. All of this can be done through the Disney Plus app, and they're starting right now.
And of course, data, data, data. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, a founding partner of Puck News. In his 1994 debut feature, Clerks, Kevin Smith introduced the world to characters like Dante and Randall, the wisecracking retail slackers, respectively played by Brian O'Halloran and Jeff Anderson. Of course, Smith himself played Silent Bob in that movie and a bunch of others. Since then, Smith has continued to grow what he calls the View Askewniverse, films, comic books, and more built around these characters. His latest addition to that world is Clerks 3. Neither Smith nor his characters are as young as they used to be, and Clerks 3 was very much informed by Smith's serious 2018 heart attack. At one point in the film, Jeff Anderson's Randall, having passed out at work, finds himself in a hospital bed where he's greeted by actress Amy Sedaris, dressed as a witch, complete with broomstick.
Are you the doctor?
I'm the doctor, Dr. Leidenheim. I'll be your savior this evening.
What in the f***?
I apologize for my wardrobe. I just came from a costume ball.
Listen, Doc, I'm okay. I can't catch my breath is all.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad would you say your pain level is?
My pain level? It's like a negative 3.
Well, you're doing it all wrong. You're supposed to be in a lot of pain when you have a heart attack.
For years now, Kevin Smith has managed to work in Hollywood while simultaneously devising his own ways of financing and releasing his movies. He's got a lot going on, and he has a great deal to say about many aspects of an industry in transition. So, Masters of the Universe, you created and exec produced and wrote the animated Masters of the Universe thing for Netflix, right?
My original pitch was a series called Kim Masters of the Universe.
As it should be.
They weren't going for it. They thought that was too snake eating its own tail. And so I had to settle for Mattel's Masters of the Universe. Rob David at Mattel and Teddy Biaselli at Netflix were the brain children behind it. And they brought me on because Rob had read my Daredevil years ago in comics. And he was like, well, when Kevin wants to be serious with a character, he could do a good job. And so he asked me if I wanted to come on to Masters of the Universe. They had this idea of doing a kind of sequel series. Like if you enjoyed the cartoon as a kid and you were now like in your 40s, this show was going to be for you to watch with your kids. And so I'm down like a clown. It was great. I've written comic books for years, so I've handled other people's IP, as they call it, and done so reverently without, you know, throwing in fart jokes. So that debuted right as we were getting started on Clerks 3. We started shooting Clerks 3 on my 51st birthday last year on August 2nd.
Nice.
And Masters of the Universe had like dropped a few days prior to that.
I know that Netflix had all sorts of Masters of the Universe business in mind. I just want to know how the Netflix experience was for you.
The Netflix experience for me was idyllic. And here's why. I can't speak to the entire channel. I worked with one guy who blew me away. He was the most creative executive I've had. You know, I've been in this business many years, Kim, like yourself. My idea of a creative executive was established in the early 90s. And, you know, the creative executive is generally an oxymoron of sorts. I've never found them to be helpful. They don't understand story. It's ridiculous notes. The new generation of creative execs are writers and creatives. And so you're getting not just a boss, but a partner. So Ted Biasali, man, made it bliss. This number one, this is a guy who like loves Masters of the Universe. So it was a childhood dream come true to make a Shakespearean version of it. You know, he always felt like it's one of the greatest franchises in the world, but you know, everyone treats it like it's a dopey kids thing. And he's like, but I always saw it as Shakespeare, and I just once want to see it be treated like that. So having him as a boss like made all the difference. It was like having a co-writer.
And how much information did they give you, if any, about like people are watching it or it's going to be successful?
They do a thing with you. It's in intervals. I think we did it 1 month after the drop. And then I think 2 months after the drop or 3 months after the drop, where you get on a phone call with, you know, the execs and the folks who do the math over at Netflix. And they tell you how many people watched it, where it was watched, how deep they went into the series. They're giving you an equation whereby, what is the term of art they use for it? It essentially means the movie's in profit. But there's two conditions. You're either that or you're not that. And that word, which escapes me, means the movie or the show, whatever the project, has received enough attention, views to, in the algorithm, pay for itself or more. So that's how you get to a season two.
So this leads me to Kilroy Was Here, which you did. And we're all deep into it. Things Kim doesn't understand right now.
Totally.
You are going to sell the distribution rights to the film as an NFT. I know that NFT stands for non-fungible token. Other than that, I'm like, what?
We released the movie in the metaverse, I guess, for lack of a better description. The folks at Secret Network as a company that's built on internet privacy, on blockchain privacy. They had worked with Quentin prior to us. They had sold Pulp Fiction as a script, as an NFT, a script that had never been published with extra stuff in it. So after that project was very successful for them, Guy, the head of Secret Network, reached out to David Shapiro, who is our producer on Kilroy Was Here, which was a little movie that we made in Sarasota with the Ringling College of Art and Design college kids. So years later, we have this thing and we could take it out to market. But David Shapiro, our producer, is big in the field of crypto. He's a big metaverse guy, big NFT collector. And so he'd been singing their praises forever. And I said to him at one point, I was like, David, has anybody ever released an entire feature as an NFT? And he said, no, my God, we could be the first. And I was like, well, you're the producer of the movie. You put up all the cash and stuff. You know, if this is your playground and where you'd like to go with the movie, I've released a movie traditionally many times. I've sold a movie a few times. So like I've done the process, you know, post heart attack. Now I just do to see if it can be done. There's never been a career path. There's never been and one day I'll get to the Oscar. No, not at all. I've just always been like, ooh, what's this? Ooh, what's this? And then post heart attack, even more so. Now I'm living on borrowed time. So I'm like, I'm just going to do whatever I want. And hopefully it's interesting to the audience at the very least, and maybe it kind of knocks open a few doors for other people.
Coming up after the break, Kevin Smith shares why a conventional theatrical release for Clerks 3 wouldn't make sense. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. In Kevin Smith's latest installment in the Clerks movie franchise, lead characters Randall and Dante, two slackers who have glimpsed their own mortality, realize that what they really want to do is make a movie. In an early brainstorming session, the pair comes up with some predictably sophisticated ideas for the project.
I don't want this movie to be about other movies. I want it to be about me. It's my flick, so I want to write about the things that I do. Like how we play hockey on the rooftop. I've never seen that done in a movie or a TV show, even though it's just practical.
Remember that fight where I hit you in the face with the bread? Ooh, that could be a scene.
By the time I spit water on that old guy, that's like the opening scene.
Aside from making this latest Clerks movie, Smith has been busy with an array of projects, including one in the Warner's DC universe that didn't happen. I wanted to talk about Strange Adventures, which you were going to do for HBO Max. And just briefly, don't want to talk about it at length, but they did drop it. And you were like, okay, that makes sense. I read somewhere that each episode was going to cost between $16 and $20 million. Is that even...
Yeah. They were, when I first spoke to the folks at Berlanti about the show, they reached out to me. Sarah Schechter reached out to me and she's like, we're doing a show called Strange Adventures. And I know you always wanted to write on the CW shows. Every time I was directing, I was like, can I write the episode? But that's a completely different department. So she was like, I know you've always wanted to write something. How would you like to write and direct an episode of this anthology series? You can pick any one of these characters from the DC universe. Like it was, you know, obviously not Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman. It was like all lower tier characters. The idea was they have all this IP and they're like, you know, how about we just start making stories with all of it so that people know these other characters. Maybe something takes off, it becomes something else. So, you know, I was like, all right, like, so, you know, I guess keep it in the $4 million range because that was roughly the budget of those CW shows, $3 to $4 million an episode. And Sarah was like, no, this is HBO Max. So we're talking about 16 to 20 per episode. And I was like, are you f-ing me? And she says, yeah, these are mini movie pilots. They could turn out to be like something else. So they want them to be cinematic and quality. They want, you know, essentially to make Game of Thrones style episode pilots with this anthology series and have a bunch of different filmmakers handle these characters in a bunch of different styles. So it was very ambitious. I was like, look, I'm happy to ride this as long as they feel it's going to happen. But I always felt like there's no way this moves forward. However, the mandate early on under the other administration was just like HBO Max is everything. So it became more believable. You know, we got paid to write the scripts, which doesn't really say that much. They pay people to write scripts all the time. But we got into like casting conversations as well as to who would play Perry White, who would play Jimmy Olsen, and who would play our bizarro Superman. Because that's what the episode was chiefly about. You know, it went radio silent toward the end of that merger. And then I guess we got an email, me and Eric Carrasco, we wrote it together. He was a writer I knew from Supergirl, a wonderful kid. We got an email from Jonathan over at Berlanti saying like, yeah, it's dead. The whole project's been scrapped. At first we thought ours was scrapped. Like they're like, get out of your mind. But they liked ours quite a bit. Like we were the first one in and they were like, if we don't get other scripts soon, we might just lead with this regardless. You know, because they had high hopes for it. I saw Perry White as John Goodman.
I read that.
Loving the death, but they saw him as like Harrison Ford. And I was like, I ain't arguing that. Right? But we all thought Bizarro as Superman as Nick Cage. And this was going to be my chance to close the loop on that bizarre Superman story from years ago. But alas, it all went away.
It all went away. And you were like, okay, I get that.
Yeah. Oh my God. That made sense. Like, you know, it's to me, like the idea of, you have a finished movie and you're going to shelve it. Like that's a little tougher to, or.
Well, that's where I'm going because the Batgirl thing was, you were like, no, I read somewhere where you said you think it couldn't possibly be terrible. I think it potentially could be pretty not great, but wow. Pulling the plug on a thing like that. That is amazing.
Well, somebody had seen it recently in those funeral screenings and said that it was a very expensive or overly expensive CW pilot.
Yes.
And I'm like, yeah, but those CW pilots put a lot of money in those WB coffers for many years. Comic book audiences are very forgiving. So it's not like, you know, comic book audiences would have seen this and been like, oh, you know, some would have, sure, but a lot of people wouldn't have. Fans just want to see their characters up there. I've since read many articles and I kind of understand their math. Like I'm not smart enough to understand the math of big business, but I guess an article I read about the inventory problem that all streamers are starting to face is something that never occurred to me in as much as like, you got to pay residuals on all this. And if you're paying residuals on something that sits there with nobody watching it, then you're just throwing good money after bad. So, you know, I'm not saying like I condone it, but I'm like, well, I understand what they're trying to do business wise. It's a new business. Streaming has only existed for what, a decade at this point? And now they're figuring out, can something live on a service forever? Or does it cost more money if nobody's watching it? You know, just like at any store, if it's not selling, they take it off the shelf. But I think it was just so shocking to hear that they had a $90 million basically finished movie that wasn't going to see the light of day. I got no real skin in the game and we were going to make a thing, but just as a fan of the platform, I actually like HBO Max as a streamer, man. And I thought they were really good. And you know, they got good quick in as much as they haven't been around as long as Netflix, but they became a pretty dominant place to go for me at least. But apparently somebody upstairs at WB Discovery knows better.
Well, I think that, you know, they want to make DC into a Marvel like entity. So maybe they felt like this is not the way. But on the other hand, I don't think it is actually possible to just toss a movie like that into the dumpster without creating terrible optics. And they're under so much financial pressure at this point that, you know, you and I can't do the math. I certainly can't. But you sort of wonder whether this company has just been so burdened with debt and trouble that it's almost impossible to figure it out and make it work. And to have that thought about Warner Brothers is kind of
strange for such a behemoth. Yeah. But, you know, like, I live in a microcosm of our business, and one could read the tea leaves financially all the time. You know, I've had a lot of people be like, why can't you just release Clerks 3 the way everybody releases a movie? And I'm like, because it doesn't make financial sense at all. Like, this is a movie with an ardent following, but it's not worldwide. It's very localized and in pockets. And the way we choose to release the movie is kind of makes the most financial sense. Like, Lionsgate was all about making the movie. They weren't about spending another 10 to 20 million to release the movie in like 2000 screens. And
10 honestly, to 20 would be a bargain, honestly. I don't think it'd be a lot more.
Can I ask a question then?
I doubt I can answer it, but go ahead.
How could it be more when we live in a world where nobody watches television anymore? So commercials for a movie mean nothing. You know, back in the day, the most expensive part of releasing a movie was like the TV campaign, the commercials. So since that doesn't really exist or shouldn't exist because it seems like a waste of money, where's all the money? Certainly not on newspaper ads or magazine ads.
They've got to go somewhere with the ads. So they go somewhere with the ads. They go,
online. I go online. Yeah. It's free, Kim. Like, you know, I market all my for free online. If I want to juice it up, I go to Facebook and I spend a little on the publicity department or, you know, spend a little publicity bucks. But like, it's ridiculous that the costs of releasing a movie have gone up when you don't do it the same way at all anymore. So for me, doing what we do makes absolute sense. This is a way for a movie to actually make money. And you just have to put in the time. Like, a lot of filmmakers might not be willing to like accompany their movie cross country and stuff, but that's why I did it, because we were on the Reboot Roadshow tour and I was like, this is how I want to live my life. This is how I want to disseminate my art. I want to sit there and I'll make movies. And then, you know, we could release them on Fathom screens so everybody could go see them if they're near a Fathom event screening. But I'm going to be on the road with my movie, sitting down every night with 1,000 people consuming this. And every night it was like going to a church where I was both the priest and Jesus at the same time. It was amazing. Okay. So I'm telling you, like,
I can see the allure. Yeah.
Oh my God, it's fantastic. And this gives me a way to correct the past, Masters. Like, one of the things that always bugged me was Tusk. Like, we make this batshit crazy movie.
It's like you're anticipating everything I'm about to say, but go on. Do go on.
We make this crazy movie cost $3 million, right? Hmm. And A24 picks it up to release it. And, you know, they're the greatest company in the world for this movie. However, at that time, in the infancy of their company, you know, a lot of their money came from some DirecTV deal. We were able to secure foreign distribution for Tusk from the good folks at Sony. So Sony gave them a bunch of money. But the caveat was, hey, this has to be like a real release. You got to put it out on like 600 screens or something like that. And I had been interested in touring the movie as we toured Red State. And I was like, that's how you reach the audience and that's how you make money rather than like just carpet bombing and stuff like that. But because of their deal, and I'm not faulting them, I'm not saying they did something wrong, but because of their deal, A24 released Tusk on 600 screens with no marketing money whatsoever. They were like, well, you've got a lot of followers on Instagram and Twitter. Mm. That was it. Like, I, you know, so at the end of the day, I watched Tusk implode. A movie that if they had just released it in New York and LA, we would have broken single screen records that month. But instead, because of a deal, they went out on a bunch of screens without the means to support the movie, and the movie died. And I had to eat publicly about it. So Good news is this. You live long enough. I lived through the heart attack 4.5 years ago. You live long enough, you start doing just to correct the past. And what's going to happen is now I've had 8 years of people to grow to know what Tusk is. It's an infamous movie. So 2 years from now is the 10-year anniversary of when Tusk came out. I would be an idiot, a terrible businessman, and a terrible storyteller, knowing that I have more story to tell if I didn't follow it up now that everybody knows what it is. So very simply, we're making a sequel in 2024, and it's called Tusks, as opposed to Tusk, got an S at the end, and that S, in honor of Jim Cameron, when his pitch for Aliens, has a dollar sign running through it, Masters. That's my naked goddamn ambition, is to make a very successful version of Tusk, which I know it would have been had I released it my way. So you'd be damn Skippy. I'm going to be touring the fuck out of that movie. I was trying to figure out, how do I top the convenience tour, man? Like, the Jay and Silent Bob Reboot Roadshow tour was like a celebration of like, he's fucking alive, let's have a party. And that's what that movie was for fans. Critics, not so much. Clerks 3 is more of a meditation on living. Still going to be a party and but is definitely more thoughtful, bring tissues.
You rewrote the whole thing, right?
From an old version that I did that was set like after Hurricane Sandy. Yeah, this one is predicated more on my heart attack. I gave Randall my heart attack. It lacks the authenticity that Clerks had. Clerks is dripping with authenticity because it was made by an earnest young filmmaker who dreamed about being considered a director, who literally worked in the same store where they shot the movie. You can't get more authentic than that. But like, I ain't that kid anymore. Now I own stores. I own Jay and Silent Bob's Secret Stash for 25 years. Now I own a movie theater. I'm the boss. And I'll tell you right now, if one of my employees is like, this job would be great if it wasn't for the customers, I'd be like, you're fired. You know, changes obviously when you're in charge. So at the end of the day, like, I don't have the authenticity of working in retail to lend to a Clerk sequel. What I do have is the authenticity of my life, because that's all Clerks was. My life was working at the convenience store, and I just did a snapshot of my life. This time, the snapshot of my life is Randall has the heart attack I had, and then in the process decides that he wants to make the movie I made. So this movie is dripping with authenticity as well, just in a different way altogether. To follow that up, I got to do something special, and that's what that Tusks tour will be. That'll be a party, a madcap party, man, and a celebration of the fact that, like, you can be as stupid and creative as you want, so long as, like, you do your homework, cross your T's, dot your I's, and make sure you get people their money back. That's all I'm interested in as an elderly filmmaker. That way I can make whatever I want. Nobody can tell me I can't make this or that because, oh, nobody's going to show up. I'm like, great, I'll shrink my budget down to this to equal that. I mean, this the only reason, Masters, we got to make Clerks 3, God bless the audience, is because they bought enough DVDs and Blu-rays. Yes, they still exist, of Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. Lionsgate had home video for us. Like, Saban had a theatrical, Universal had overseas, and Lionsgate had home video on Jay and Silent Bob Reboot. And after the video was done, they reached out to Liz Destro and Jordan Monsanto, my producers, and they were like, look, you got any more of this Jay and Silent Bob bullshit you want to make and it costs under $7 million, bring it here, because you guys killed on home video. And I was like, I do have a Jay and Silent Bob piece of bullshit to make. I've been trying to make Clerks 3 for the better part of 10 years. So my dream came true because people bought DVDs and Blu-rays, because they didn't sit around and just stream it like I do.
I'm glad you got to make it. Kevin Smith wrote and directed Clerks 3. The film has a limited theatrical release starting September 13th. Kevin, I always love talking to you.
Masters, you can rock, man. I'm telling you, we're going to get that Kim Masters of the Universe series made.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Matt Schwartz and Paul Smith, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.